Now we're joined in the studio by Michael Hart, who is the co-author with Antonio Negri of the book Empire, which came out earlier this year from Harvard University Press. And unlike the mainstream media, we're not obsessed with complete novelty, but it is a relatively new book. Welcome to WBAI, Michael Hart.
Thanks.
You are a professor of literature in the literature program at Duke University. For those in the audience who might not know your co-author's name, Antonio Negri, could you just give us a little capsule bio of who he is and what he's up to now?
Cut me off if I go on too long. He was a professor of politics in Padua in Italy. He's Italian. In the 60s and 70s, and he was very involved in the 60s and 70s with worker student revolutionary groups. His, in addition to his teaching in the university in a politics department, in as the 70s proceeded, in particular after the assassination of Aldo Moro by the Red Brigades, there was a general repression of the extreme left, I guess it was called. And as part of the sort of largest attack against those who had been involved, he was arrested in 1979. He spent, at that point, 4.5 years in prison before he came to trial. And in a strange, particularly Italian move, he was released from prison because he was elected to parliament, because Italy has a law that a member of parliament can't be held for a political crime. He was elected and to represent all those who were still in jail for this government repression, in which when they tried to revoke his immunity, he escaped to France and spent 14 years in Paris in an exile in Paris. Now, just in 1998 or 1997, he returned to Italy voluntarily to try to both solve his own case but also push for a amnesty or a political resolution to the continuing legal difficulties of those involved in leftist politics in the 70s.
And now he's, what, in some kind of halfway house arrangement?
He has what they call external work arrangement, where he is in prison at night and out during the day.
And I heard a rumor he'd become a Catholic. Is that true?
No. He did write for a nun who was helping him with his case. He wrote for her Catholic publication a article about his Catholic youth, sort of in a series about Catholic youth of different people. Something actually I haven't read, but he...
Right. I had a Catholic youth, too, so
I
doesn't
too.
Make me a Catholic
yeah.
today.
Yeah.
So let's get to the book.
Yes.
This is kind of a big question since you wrote a whole book about this, but it's a good place to start. What do you mean by empire? How is it different from previous conceptions of empire?
Well, there are two... I think there are two ways of answering it, and these are really two of our initial conceptions about the book. One is that they all start in the negative, really. One of our primary conceptions, or even impetus for working on the project, was the thought that it's not accurate to define the contemporary global order as a regime of U.S. imperialism. And what we mean by that, really, is that if one were to think of the contemporary world order as U.S. imperialism, it would mean, in effect, that the U.S. nation-state now has adopted the forms of global or at least international rule that the European powers had used previously. So our first moment, the first way we want to use the term empire somewhat awkwardly at times, is in distinction from imperialism, to say that the character of the imperialist regimes, essentially the European nation states and their imperialist regimes, has ended, and what we have now is something new. Then there's a large burden put on us to say what's new about it, but that's at least the impetus. There's another direction, though, about a negative way, and the reason that the way empire functions for us And this starts with a double negative, really. It seems to us that there are two common notions, extremes or caricatures, but I think still functioning, about what global political order is. On one hand, there's the notion that there is a single power that dictates global order. This is what I think of as the conspiracy theory of global order, as if there were a power behind all the things that happen. And often it appears this way, and there's certain truth in it. For instance, during the Gulf War or Kosovo, there's a way in which the Pentagon does have a kind of monarchical control. But that we think that it's false and not productive to think about this single power dictating global order. On the other hand, there's also a rather common notion, and here again a sort of caricature of it, quite common on the right, I assume, which is that there really is no global political order. In fact, now, finally, economic forces have freed themselves of political controls and state controls, and that global order, if there is such a thing, arises spontaneously from the myriad of economic and cultural exchanges. This is what I think of as the invisible hand theory of global order, which I think is equally false. So between the two, between the conspiracy theory of a single order and the invisible hand theory of a kind of order rising out of anarchy, we try to form, this is the way the concept of empire functions for us, as a way of understanding the multiplicity of elements that together function within a single constitution.
All right, well, if we look, I mean, I'm sort of partial to the U.S. Domination theory, dinosaur that I am, but I look, you know, you mentioned Kosovo, the Gulf War, but also I mean, I look at an institution like the IMF, which is effectively run by the United States, even though it looks like a multilateral body. I mean, it is in some sense the United States more than the first among equals in this new kind of empire.
Absolutely. There is certainly, the U.S. does occupy, among nation states, it occupies a privileged position with respect to others. Part of the our argument and the burden of the argument is really also about the status of the nation state, because it seems to us that that imperialism, the way it functioned in the era of the European powers, really, imperialism was an extension of the powers of the nation state beyond its own borders, and relied it for foundation on the powers of the nation state. It seems to us that now it's not one of the elements that argues against thinking of this as a stage of U.S. imperialism, is that it's not the U.S. nation state in the same way. That's not to say at all, of course, that nation states are no longer important, that they have no function, etc. But it's not the nation state, the U.S. nation state, that functions as the foundation and that creates the world in a series of inside-outside relationships, which seem to me characteristic of imperialism. There's another regard, a further one, and I'm not sure how this would fit with your way of thinking about it, which is that it seems to me, at least, that imperialism, as we knew it, as a European form, was necessarily multiple. There was imperialism meant competition among imperialist powers. There was never just a single imperialism. And so it's already a fundamental difference now that the global order isn't defined by the contest among imperialist powers. Already thinking of the U.S. as the sole superpower indicates the need, I think, for thinking of a different situation and different criteria to judge it.
There are a lot of folks who argue that multinational corporations and restless financial capital have made the nation state completely obsolete. Where do you stand on that argument?
Well, there's one. Let's see. It seems to me useful thinking about it to start from the perspective that capitalists individual capitalists have always had an antagonistic relationship with the state. And yet, the state has always acted in the interests of collective capital. In a way, while individual capitalists occupy a conflictual relationship with the state is actually necessary for the development of capital.
The executive branch is the executive of the bourgeoisie, right?
Exactly. It acts in the interest of the collective capital. And in the long-term interest of collective capital, so that it doesn't mean that even any capitalist will necessarily agree with the state's actions at any point, but that if the state functions properly, and over the long run it, in fact, has and will, it acts to further the long-term interests and sustenance of collective capital as a whole. Well, it seems then, from that perspective, it's quite logical to say, if it's not a nation-state or even a conglomeration of nation-states that can occupy this role, there must be some state structure or some political structure that fills the role that the nation-state used to fill within a national space for global capital. And that's, in a way, what we want the notion of empire to do. It occupies, if one were to say it this way, but it's not as simple as this, that the same way that, say, British capital needed the British nation-state to act in the collective interests of British capital, global capital needs empire to act in its long-term interests and act in its collective interests. So that while it seems, I think it often seems in a mainstream or mainstream right discourse that global capital has become liberated from state structures, and it's a great thing. In fact, if it were true, they ought to be scared. But in fact, it's not true. And that's in a way what we're trying to articulate. We're trying to hypothesize too, because these are all operations that, in a way, our entire book is a kind of you might think of it as a thought experiment, although written in a bold or declarative tone. It's trying to pose an hypothesis that seems a good way to explain what's going on, without actually having the tools yet to completely understand.
It's pretty hard to understand the present, isn't it?
Yeah.
In the near future, mm-hmm. or the evolving future. You write quite a bit about deterritorialization, place being apparently less important in production. And I see also contradictory things. I mean, Silicon mm-hmm. Valley is a very important region. Wall Street, where we are right now, is a very important region. People are willing to pay very high rents to be here, even though they don't have to. I mean, what's going on with that? Is capital really as placeless and rootless as some, you know, George Gilder would have us believe?
Right. It's not a one-way operation. It's not as if the territorial relationships of capital are destroyed and then it's completely free, as if it has no place or needs no territorial relationships. It seems to me that it's a back and forth motion of, I mean, you might say, of deterritorialization and then reterritorialization. But there is the potential for movement. It's not always used, and it's true that there are locations that for certain periods will construct a territory that matters financially. But there's nothing necessary about that. It could change.
You write also at several points that are fairly critical of people who have nostalgia for the nation state. A lot of leftists, for example, mm-hmm. a lot of Greens who write about localization, relocalization. But I think at one point you used the phrase, which I love, a healthy and lucid contempt for that kind of nostalgia. Why are you so healthily and lucidly contemptuous of that?
Well, first, the nation state. I think they're two separate contempts we're talking about there. The nation state seems to us the wrong forum for political action, and that nationalism in any of its forms seems to us necessarily to bring with it structures of hierarchy and subordination. So that
and exclusion, right?
And exclusion, exactly. So that so for instance, one of the ways we put it is that it can seem logical when one thinks about the potential mobilities of global capital. Like you say, that they're limited, but there's some cases when they're real. It might seem that with the globalization of capital or global movements of capital, it would be logical to oppose it with by insisting on the nation state because of its almost logical contrary nature. But we think that, especially given not just given the history of nation states and of nationalisms, but even in its very form, that the nation state and nationalism are not an adequate form for liberatory politics. The other matter you brought up was the localism, and it's only when we criticize this, it's only in the couple of a local isolationism, like a local versus a global perspective. The most many people writing now or thinking or even political and political movements too that think of a place-based politics or a focus on local movements that aren't conceiving place as isolated from the global, or even that the isolation itself would be the political movement. That's what we're criticizing. We're not at all criticizing movements and theories that think of either the local or the community-based or the focus on place in its relationship to the global.
Now, you also like migration, hybridity, and all this, the blurring of localities and borders.
Well, it's that we think that there, it certainly wouldn't be unqualified in that way. I mean, one of the things, one of our points against certain tendencies of political thinking about globalization, and particularly certain strains of post-colonial theory, is that those strains that think of hybridity or migration as liberatory in themselves. What we want to emphasize is that's not true. There, in fact, empire works, we say, by constructing hybrid identities through forcing migrations. There are many times in which what is liberatory is not to move, but to be free to stay in one place. Many populations that are forced into migration recognize that. And similarly, the hybridity itself is not liberatory. But with both of these, migration and hybridity, we want to say that they are not. Just because they are used by capital, because they're used by empire, doesn't mean that they can't themselves also be liberatory mechanisms, that we can't within them find a construction for something new.
So, in the 2 minutes we have remaining, as we always do in these things, how to fight empire? You've got some kind of, to use a very old phrase, some kind of proletarian internationalism going, but how do you make that real?
We don't, in this book, have a program. It's not a, even though it's
wouldn't trust anyone who did, so.
Yeah. In a way, there are movements that emerge, and they're emerging today, it seems to me, that are constructing. I mean, using proletarian internationalism as a model is certainly, that's the foundation or the stream on which our thinking is based. And specifically, what we argue, or at least pose, and it's an extremely high challenge to meet, is that the alternative to this contemporary empire will only arrive on the same level of globality, on the same global level. That it will, and it's a very difficult thing to imagine how we could organize a global alternative. But that, in a way, is the upshot of our argument.
Well, we got a few seconds remaining, but I mean, are things like what we call Seattle now? I mean, are these sort of foretastes of the kinds of things you have in mind?
Absolutely. With all the inspiration and the limitations that Seattle and the subsequent events have posed. Yes.
Well, thank you very much, Michael Hart. I've been speaking with Michael Hart, co-author with Antonio Negri of the book Empire, recently published by Harvard University Press, and. very provocative book that everyone should pick up a copy and read. Thank you. Good luck with the book, Michael Hart. And that's it for me, Doug Henwood.